From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Philip K. Howard's book, Life Without Lawyers, explores how this country came to be flooded with rules and legal threats and lawsuits. Having to strain daily choices through a legal sieve, Howard says, is killing the human instinct needed to get things done. Howard's book focuses on freedom, which he says includes the joy of spontaneity, the power of personal conviction, the authority to use common sense to interact with students or patients or neighbors. Today in the program, a conversation with Philip K. Howard about his idea of creating a legal framework of right and wrong that takes into account the rights of a community as a whole. We invite you to join us after this news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You've all heard the outrageous examples of lawsuit excess. The woman who sued McDonald's over a cup of hot coffee. The Washington, D.C. lawyer who sued his dry cleaner for $54 million. But Philip K. Howard says you don't have to look far to see the effects of this hyper-litigious culture. Go to a school playground or a classroom or your doctor and you'll see the way society is trying to strip away anything that carries the slightest bit of risk. Well, Howard says risk is natural. And in his book, Life Without Lawyers, he explains just how we got to this point of having to strain daily choices through a legal sieve. The book presents his vision for a social structure where people are free to make choices and respond to instinct and use common sense. For Howard, this is about freedom and boundaries. And don't let the title fool you. This isn't an attack on lawyers. It's a critique of a culture that has become infected with distrust. Philip K. Howard is a lawyer and a public policy activist. He's the author of The Death of Common Sense and the Collapse of the Common Good. He's also the founder of Common Good, a nonprofit that focuses on health, education, and civil justice. And he's joining us today from the studios of National Public Radio in New York City. And Philip K. Howard, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Doug.
I want to begin by asking just how you got started on all of this. I mean, it seems like some of it may have been personal. I mean, you've written about growing up in the South where you got this, at least as I understand it, this sort of deep sense of freedom to be yourself, which you call the greatest gift of American culture. Is that what got you started, is feeling restricted?
Well, actually, yeah. Southern culture is a little stultifying, to be honest. It's the reason I live in New York. I've always been interested in public policy for whatever reason. And, I got my start at the Oak Ridge National Lab when I was in college. And I sort of used my outlet for that was doing civic work, being head of the equivalent of the zoning board in Midtown Manhattan when I was a young lawyer, things like that. But the more I became active in civic work, the more idiotic many of the requirements of government seemed to be. And I had all these friends who were in very responsible positions who didn't have the authority to make sense of the situation before them. Hmm. And the more I looked into it, the more it seemed like there was something wrong with law that prevented them from using their common sense. And so that started me to reading and thinking about it, and it ended up being a book. And the book, The Death of Common Sense, ended up being, much to especially my wife's surprise, ended up being a huge bestseller and everything. And I ended up working for several years with Al Gore and his Reinventing Government program, and became more active in national public policy.
It must give you a sense that this really that particular book, The Death of Common Sense, and this one, Life Without Lawyers, it must really resonate for a lot of people. You must get some passionate reactions to it all.
Well, I do. It's been very satisfying. Both books are now used, even the new one, are starting to be used in schools. So I get lots of feedback from high school students and college students about the ideas in the book and their role in a free society and the role of government and such. So yeah, it's been very satisfying in that sense.
I want to ask you about that. It seems in some ways this is sort of a reflection on the nature of freedom. You say in the book that freedom is supposed to be about originality and spontaneity. Is freedom at the heart of your argument, do you think?
Yes, it is. Well, I think human power is at the heart of my argument. You know, what was great about America and was different from the old country is that in America you could invent yourself, fail, pick yourself up, and reinvent yourself. There was this sense of limitlessness. I mean, there were all these constraints of life, but you could do with it what you could. Whereas in the old country, if you were the child of a carpenter, you grew up being a carpenter. You know, that was your place in life in a feudal society.
Right.
And that's why America was so exceptional, and lots of people have written about that. But that freedom, that capacity of invention, implies a capacity of a freedom to focus on your goal through ambition. Hmm. And in the last few decades, as law has become, has been pressed down into daily choices, it's as if everybody has a little lawyer on their shoulder, whispering in their ear, you might get in trouble, you better not say that. It's really transformed the way people, particularly people who deal with the public, like teachers and doctors, how they do their jobs, and it makes them tend to fail. Hmm. And I go through that a little in the book. The people are smart in ways that they don't fully understand. Succeeding in life is not a question of drawing up a logical diagram. It's these spurts forward that come out of instinct and experience and things like that. And smart, you know, Peter Drucker, the management consultant, or Chester Barnard, another famous writer on management, they both make this point that the people can't explain how they get things done.
Yeah.
You know, they just have a kind of a gift, an instinct, a willpower, and all that. But if you make people self-conscious, they can't access that smart part, that hidden part of their brain. So it actually has a significant cognitive impact when you put law or legal fear into daily choices.
You write about fairness in the book, and you say that freedom is not defined by fairness. Freedom is defined by the outside boundaries of what is legally unfair. And you say there's a difference.
Yeah, there's a huge difference, which is really not appreciated. And I'm going to try to make this point during the Sotomayor confirmation hearings. Because there's this sense that if anything goes wrong in life, that law should be available.
Right.
Well, that's not what freedom's not a, like getting the right answer on a test. You know, freedom is supposed to be this open field of possibilities. And it's law that draws these boundaries. And so is a high dive at a nursery school an unreasonable risk? I would say probably yes. You know,
right, right.
4-year-olds shouldn't be, fooling around 10 feet in the air. Is it a reasonable risk at a pool for teenagers and adults? Well, maybe it is. And so somebody needs to draw those boundaries. But instead, of course, all those boards have been taken out in America. Mm. So it's very hard even to train to be an Olympic diver because you can't find a diving board. Law needs to draw those lines, and it no longer does that. Instead, it's become a kind of an open season. Anytime there's an accident, you can always claim there should have been better supervision. Mm. Every single accident. I mean, it couldn't be easier to bring a claim every time something goes wrong. Something could always have been done differently. That shouldn't be the standard of law.
You talk about the origins of how we came to this point, and you say that there are these two intellectual currents that came together. The first, which you say grew out of the Industrial Revolution, is this idea of organizing how to do things. We are intent on getting a structure, getting it organized. And the second is this idea of individual rights, which is to let any individual who, as you write, feels aggrieved bring a legal claim for almost anything. Talk about how these two things came together and sort of brought us to where we are.
Yeah, it's such an interesting point because for most of human history, communities were really quite small. People knew each other. you didn't need law to tell the businessman not to abuse his workers. People wouldn't work for him anymore, or
right.
whatever.
Right.
But as companies became big, we realized that the laissez-faire philosophy couldn't work, that you couldn't trust these big anonymous companies to do things fairly. And so we need regulation, for example. And so I'm not an anti-regulation person. I'm a pro-regulation person. But even in regulation, you need to leave the regulator with the room to make judgments.
Hmm.
Instead, we created this regulatory system, which we still more or less have, which is over 100 million words of federal law that's binding. Well, that's ridiculous. Nobody can know it. You know, OSHA, the Worker Safety Agency, has, you know, 4,000 rules that tell people how high the railings have to be. And so you get a ticket if the railing's 41 inches instead of 42 inches. That makes not one bit of difference as to worker safety. You know, it's just, it's, and of course, nobody could read, nobody has the time to read all the rules.
Right.
So it's just not practical. It's not important. And in fact, when we were doing the Reinventing Government project, we in fact did make a number of reforms in OSHA, and I became very friendly with the head of OSHA, redirecting their efforts towards a culture of safety and training, which really makes a difference, not this kind of central planning idea. So one idea was this idea, if you're going to have law, it should be really precise and tell people exactly what to do. Mm. And that in fact, is nothing different than central planning. And if you pick up any volume of the U.S. Code and just pick it up and start reading it, you will ask yourself within a minute, why is this in here? You know, do you really need to tell the Secretary of Health that he has 16 days to respond to a fund application? You know, it's just, you know, it's just, it's way too detailed. So that was one trend. And then when we woke up to all these abuses in the 1960s of racism and gender discrimination and despoiling the environment, I mean, just the whole, and then we had on top of that the Vietnam War, it's hardly surprising that we wanted to create a system that was somehow better than the people who were in charge. And so we got this idea of letting any individual who didn't like anything to bring a claim. And, you know, so it would be self-executing. Right. Anyone could. And it's just great in theory. The trouble is, you know, what about the, as you said at the beginning, what about the rights of the rest of the community? When somebody asserts their rights, it's against something. And it's usually against the decision by the teacher or the principal or the supervisor, you know, or the government official, or President Obama is trying to build a power line. And now somebody who doesn't like the power line is going to hold it up for 5 years with litigation. So all of a sudden, you got a formula for paralysis, and that's kind of where we are.
You tell the story in the book of a young man in 1995 was diving into a lake in the Cheshire region of England, dove in too sharply, broke his neck, became paralyzed. And there was a lawsuit, and it made it, as you say, to the highest court in Britain. And the court rendered this decision that you said was almost unheard of in America. It ordered the case to be dismissed. And I wanted you to break that case down and talk about what's the difference and the ruling that they came to, which they applied that the rights of this young man against the broader rights of the community. And it's really intriguing what they came to. I wanted you to talk about that, if you would.
Yes, it's almost a prototypical accident. It was, you know, the person, it was just an accident. I mean, there was no hidden danger, but it was a lake in a public park. The county knew that there were going to be accidents there because there were two or three near drownings a year because hundreds of thousands of people use the park. And indeed, they were so scared of liability that they had ordered the lake to be closed, and they were going to try to implement it by planting reeds and putting mud on the beaches and such, and so no one could use it anymore. Mm-hmm. But before that happened, this fellow went for a swim and had this tragic accident. So it went to the lower court, which said, well, it was clearly foreseeable that there would be accidents. The records, you know, of the county are replete with their fears. Therefore, he should recover. And when it got up to the high court, they said, yes, it was foreseeable, but allowing a lawsuit when there's an accident doesn't just compensate the victim in this case, it also has an effect on the rest of society. It means, as was going to happen in this county, the lake was going to close down so that hundreds of thousands of people a year would not get the pleasure of swimming and boating in the lake, and that rivers and lakes across the country will close down if they're going to be liable when the inevitable accident occurs. And so one of the judges said, we will not sanction a dull and gray safety regime.
Yeah.
It is our job to represent the interest of all the society and to draw boundaries of what's a reasonable risk. We hold that public lakes are a reasonable risk for society, and we're not going to ban them or effectively ban them by letting any accident victim claim, you know, bring a lawsuit.
So how is it that that would be a ruling that would be perfectly reasonable or acceptable in Great Britain but not here? Or would it be? I mean, how would that sort of a notion be received here?
Well, first of all, it was a big deal in Britain when
sure.
when they did it in 2002 or whenever it finally got up there, because people just hadn't focused on the fact that letting these claims by individuals affects all of society. There's this kind of general notion that's still the presumption in this society that a lawsuit's just a dispute between two parties. Hmm. Well, that's not true. What people can sue for establishes the boundaries of everyone else's freedom. That's why there's nothing left in the in the playgrounds in America, because everybody, there's a certainty that if you leave jungle gyms and high slides and merry-go-rounds and seesaws,
yeah.
not a risk, a certainty that there will be accidents, occasional tragic accidents. But there are also lots of benefits to having those things. It teaches kids, first of all, it attracts them to the risk is part of what attracts them to the playground
sure.
and off the sofa where they're getting fat. Secondly, it teaches them to take care of themselves and to deal with, you know, the activities. So there are all these positive aspects, but it does involve the inevitability of the occasional accident. And in this country, we have the idea that there's a, quote, right to sue for anything. And part of what I'm trying to do, and I'm, you know, working hard. It's not my day job, but I'm working hard trying to do it, is I'm talking to senior judges, including Supreme Court justices and others, about the need to change our judicial philosophy to do what the British court did, which is to begin to draw boundaries where the judge sees it as part of his or her job to protect the freedoms of everyone in society, not just referee over a particular lawsuit.
Philip K. Howard is with us. His book is called Life Without Lawyers, Liberating Americans from Too Much Law. We need to take a brief break. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Philip K. Howard is joining us to talk about his latest book, Life Without Lawyers. Howard is working out how we ended up here in a society lousy with rules and lawsuits where teachers and doctors and pretty much everybody are so worried about getting sued that we've become paralyzed in some ways. For Howard, this is about freedom to be spontaneous and to use our common sense. Let's go to the phones. Phil is joining us. He's in Provo. Phil, hi.
Thank you. I appreciate your taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a trial attorney, and this has been a very interesting conversation. It reminds me of a conversation I had with my wife not long ago. I think a lot of the premises here are very accurate. I'd like to reflect on two thoughts and see what your guest has to say, Mr. Howard. The first is, I find the courts, after having practiced as a trial attorney now for over 17 years, to be an extremely inefficient place to get compensation. Litigation is probably the worst experience anyone can go through, and I always like to quote the gypsy's curse, may you win a lawsuit. The other aspect to it is, I go back to your lake example, this intriguing case out of Great Britain. I'm assuming that there's probably, in a lot of countries, more of a safety net that's available to individuals, that they don't feel like they have to resort to this incredibly inefficient litigation process because they have no choice. NPR did a very interesting tapestry of various healthcare systems last fall, where they interviewed people in Japan, Germany, England, comparing the healthcare systems here in the United States. And one of the things I think is a great impediment to the United States in reforming healthcare is that and trying to mitigate some of the aspects, for example, of malpractice, is what opportunity do people have if they get hurt? They really have right. none. I have clients who are completely physically, financially, emotionally devastated. This incredibly inefficient litigation process is all they have. And I represent them for that reason, and I feel proud to do so. But do I wish it were better? Do I wish it would work more efficiently and that everyone be protected? Absolutely. I'm just wondering what your guests would have to say about those situations and about the collision between our inefficient litigation process, yet the lack of what I perceive as being an adequate social safety net. Mm.
Philip K. Howard, you talk about this in your book.
Yeah, I think you're right on both points. First of all, the system is just staggeringly inefficient. There's a study that we're in a joint venture with the Harvard School of Public Health, and my colleagues did a study of, they looked at thousands of malpractice cases. It took an average of 5 years to get to settlement. I mean, that ruins with more or less a 25% error rate. I mean, it's just not efficient, and it's not reliable enough. One of the things that we came up with, and we're trying to get pilot projects for, would be basically expert health courts where people injured by mistakes would get recovery in a matter of months. There'd be a requirement of an open kimono by the hospitals and such, and where there would be rulings. It wouldn't be a jury system. It would be judges who would make rulings as a matter of law on the facts of each case, if it got there, of what the standard of care was. Mm. So clearly there needs to be much more, a system that gets to justice much quicker. It's just, as you know, it's very hard for an injured patient even to find a lawyer if it isn't worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, because it's going to cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars to work on it for all those years. Mm. The second point, we clearly need a better safety net as well. And probably the best example of this is cerebral palsy cases, where most of those cases, according to scientists, are not caused by whatever the doctor or hospital did. But nonetheless, there's this tragedy and a child that needs a lifetime of care that's going to cost many millions of dollars, and there's no mechanism in society or no efficient mechanism to do that. And so on the one hand, you get doctors paranoid and insurance rates going up for obstetricians or them quitting the business or whatever, which is a bad effect. On the other hand, you don't have any other place for the parents to go.
Phil, glad you called. Thanks very much. Judy is with us in Pocatello, Idaho. Judy, welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. Certainly. I'm a dedicated listener to the show, and I've been intrigued by the conversation today. And, Doug, in your opening remarks, you mentioned the McDonald's coffee cup case, the kind of infamous, huge settlement that woman received. And about 10 years ago, I had the opportunity to meet the attorney that represented her in that case. And I made some kind of a disparaging remark about the money that she received. And he said, "Do you mind if I tell you the story?" And I said, "No." And so he did tell me the story of what happened. And essentially what happened was the woman had been going to McDonald's every morning forever for her coffee. And on this particular morning, went through the drive-thru, received her coffee, and the bottom fell out of the cup. She did not spill the coffee into her lap. And McDonald's knew when they bought the paper cups that 1 in 1,000 of those cups would fail. So they had that information up front. The woman needed $22,000 or something in that neighborhood of reconstructive surgery. And so she asked McDonald's simply for that. And McDonald's refused her. And so she found this attorney who was willing to take the case. And even though McDonald's was, I should have mentioned that McDonald's was insured by Lloyd's of London, so they had plenty of coverage for this kind of situation. The attorney took the case, and the result was that she won, and the amount that the jury awarded was calculated to be simply nothing more than the total amount of profit that McDonald's makes on coffee in one day in the entire world. And so she won, and I don't remember how the appeals all worked out, but that was the essence of that case. And the reason I'm bringing it up is because he asked me to share that story every opportunity that I got, and because you brought it up this morning, I thought I'd call in because I kind of think it fits with the conversation.
So it goes to this question of corporate responsibility, I guess.
Exactly, and that's exactly what he said.
Okay,
it's
so
time for corporate America to take its responsibility.
Right. Philip K. Howard, you hear this response from time to time.
Right, right. Well, first, the point I make in my book is not whether that person should recover or not, but that there should be a ruling of law as to the responsibility of McDonald's for the how hot its coffee is. I don't really care what the ruling is. Instead, in America, those cases are done jury by jury without any ruling of law, so nobody knows where they stand. I've never heard this idea of the cup coming out of the bottom. I actually debated the McDonald's hot coffee judge years ago on Oprah, which was fun. He's a really nice guy. And I could argue that you could have a ruling of law that says coffee in a drive-in window shouldn't be so hot. But by and large, most Americans know how to deal with the risk of it. If it was a flawed product, which is to say if it's actually accurate that the bottom fell out of the cup, then the law is pretty clear that you're liable there. Every rendition of the story I've ever heard had her spilling it while taking off the cup, the top of the coffee cup, in which case it becomes, I think, a somewhat more difficult issue. But in any case, requiring, in my world at least, a judge drawing boundaries, not just letting it be decided jury by jury. And I'd like to comment on the damages. Yeah. You know, every time there's an accident, it couldn't be easier to make an argument that says, oh, I just want one day's profits, or what would you take to give up a loved one? Well, I wouldn't take anything. What would you take to lose a leg? Nothing. Law is supposed to include not only predictability as to what you can be sued for, but also generally how much you can be sued for. And this idea that people can get rich because of a tragedy, and I don't think that person, in fact, did get rich. They ended up with maybe $500,000. But is also one of the things that seeds the public with fear. Because every time you see one of those billboards that says, no, it's not the lottery, it's justice, or whatever, call 1-800-SUE-NOW. Every time you see one of those things, there's a negative message there, too, which is you could be on the other side of that. You know, you could be on the receiving end of that lawsuit.
Judy, glad you called. Thanks very much. And, I was wondering about trial lawyers that often, as a group anyway, have been resistant to tort reform. But I'm wondering, is there any softening of the ground these days? Are you hearing the trial lawyers more inclined to be receptive to reasonable changes?
Well, it's interesting. First of all, I don't think what I'm advocating is what most people would call tort reform.
Sure.
Tort reform is really about drawing arbitrary limits or set limits on what people can sue for. There probably should be some limits on not what are called non-economic damages. But in general, I'm for simply making law more reliable, including making corporations more accountable so they can't drag their heels for 5 years, when they do something wrong. So I'm for making lawsuits easier when somebody does something wrong, whereas today, in my view, the system favors whoever's in the wrong. Mm. You can extort somebody by bringing a huge claim even if they didn't do something wrong, or you can drag your heels if you did do something wrong. I don't really think that the plaintiff's bar is very receptive to change. Nobody in our society, as far as I can tell, is receptive to change. I spend a certain amount of time in Washington. I practically get a rash when I go across the bridge because nobody's going to do anything. It's just so the dynamics of Washington, which I write about in the book, are such that that it is in fact paralyzed. The Farm Bill was signed by Roosevelt in 1933, outlived its usefulness by 1940, and it's still paying $10 or $20 billion a year in subsidies to corporate farmers who don't need it. But the senators from Nebraska or wherever go to their friends and say, I won't vote for your bill if you don't vote for my farm subsidy. And so this stuff just piles up and nobody ever gets rid of it. It's, you know, there's a I guess, a meta question here, which I'm struggling with in talking to people, is how do you create the conditions for shifting away from this sort of short-term, self-interested way of looking at everything? Mm. The trial lawyers have their hands all around the legal system. They don't want to give up anything, but that's true of corporate subsidies, too. It's true across the board.
So you write about the corrosion of culture in the book being one of those factors that I guess you can sort of build into all of this. How much of this is greed, for example?
Well, greed. It's greed and avoidance of responsibility is a big part of it. People don't want to take responsibility for appearing too generous or too, I don't know. You know, everybody sees their job is cabined. I'm only working for my company. I'm only working for my industry or my profession. And partially that's greed, and partially it's just an indication of a lack of leadership. There was a party in the Senate for my book last week. And so, you know, the senators and congressmen were there and, you know, they were very complimentary and they can finish my sentences. I mean, they're living there.
Sure.
So they see everything not happening. But they don't know how to break out of it either. And they, you know, they could go on your program and they will say, we know that we could make sense out of the healthcare system, but we've got to get rid of this accumulated bureaucracy and go to a new system, experiment with things. And then, for example, Intermountain Healthcare is a very efficient and good provider of healthcare. Mm. And people would like to model other systems based on the system you have in Salt Lake City. But they don't know how to get there.
Mm. You talk about we need to decentralize power, liberate teachers from bureaucracy is not all that's needed. You say you need the freedom to judge others.
Right.
Talk about that. That's intriguing.
Yeah, it's really important. First of all, you know, in America today, there is this sense, and it's even, as I just said, in Washington, you can be a senator and feel that you can't make a difference. Yeah. It's just so paradoxical. But that's especially true, as your listeners will probably know, in your communities. Well, what are we supposed to do? Can we really affect the schools? You've got a great idea. You go to the local principal, and the principal says, "Nah, I've got all these rules. I can't do that." So there needs to be. Let's just take schools for an easy example. What does law have to do with running a school? I mean, more than it has to do with a parochial school or private school or any other school. It's just providing a service. It doesn't need to be bureaucratized. It needs an accountability mechanism. So I've been talking to the teachers union head and said, you know, if you want to professionalize or reprofessionalize teaching, let teachers take back control of the classroom. Let's just bulldoze all the rules. But because you don't need the rules as long as the teacher can be accountable if she doesn't do a good job.
Hmm.
But, of course, the teachers union requires there to be a 3-year trial, you know, to get rid of any lousy teacher. So what we've been talking about, this mutual disarmament idea, where you would basically get rid of the bureaucracy so that teachers could actually be themselves and have a personality and do what seems right in the circumstances. And when it comes to big decisions like should the teacher keep her job or not, instead of having a litigation process where you prove that somebody's incompetent, I mean, what a horrible thing to do and to have to do. Instead of having to prove it, you have a parent-teacher committee that has the authority to overturn the principal or something like that. You have a check and a balance, but it's not a trial. It's not a litigation proceeding because the truth is there's no truth.
Right.
Any any teacher who's getting, or anybody who's lost their job, and I tell the story in the book about me getting fired from a job, you always think you're being treated unfairly and you're not understood, and you always compare yourself to somebody who you think isn't as good, who's keeping their job. It's just human nature.
Yeah.
So law can't get down into those kinds of daily decisions. It's just not – it's just a formula for bitterness.
This radical idea you talk about in the book, right and wrong cannot be programmed or proved.
Yeah, it's, you know, freedom. I go back to the idea of freedom. Freedom is not demonstrating that each and everything you did is correct. It's not like picking the right path across a raging river, you know, where you're hopping from one stone to the next. Freedom is supposed to be this dry ground where you can do it. You can do it your way. And when you push law down to the daily choices, it becomes more like the, you know, picking your way across the, you know, the raging river.
Philip K. Howard is with us. His book is Life Without Lawyers, Liberating Americans from Too Much Law. We're going to take another brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Philip K. Howard is with us talking about his new book, Life Without Lawyers, Liberating Americans from Too Much Law. Philip Howard, you were talking earlier about these health courts, and it reminded me of something you say in the book. You're talking about this distrust we have for authority, and you're telling the story about going to lunch with this good friend of yours, a respected journalist, and you were talking about these health courts, and you said her reaction was telling. You talk about this distrust of authority as being just the mindset of our time, really palpable.
Yeah, it really is unbelievable. It's so self-destructive. So I was having – actually, I had lunch with her last week in Los Angeles. She didn't know she was in the book. And so I'm talking about this idea of having – trying to create a reliable court system so that doctors could focus on taking care of their patients and wouldn't waste billions in defensive medicine, things like that. And she said, well – who's going to appoint the judges? I said, well, they could be appointed by however you want, by an independent committee. And so who's going to appoint the committee? I said, well, you can appoint it anyway, but you can't not have a decision-making mechanism because you don't trust anyone in the world. Humans have to make choices in a society at every level of responsibility. Mm-hmm. But her mindset, and I think it's not uncommon, was that any position of responsibility is an opportunity for, abuse or something,
right,
which I guess it is. But that doesn't mean, we can create this kind of software program that runs society. Somebody has to decide whether a seesaw is a reasonable risk of life or not. Someone has to decide, what the standards are for firing people in the government, I guess. Mm-hmm. But, people have to you have to make choices in life. That's what freedom is about. It's about choices. And the more complicated society gets, the more important it is that we have regulators and officials of one sort or another. And if they're disempowered, then the society doesn't work. Yeah. And one of the points I make is that if the principal doesn't have the authority to make exceptions or make choices, then what good are the teacher's ideas? And what good are the parents' ideas? Authority should always be accountable, but it should be accountable up the chain, not down the chain. And it's a hub for everybody else's freedom. It's a way for things to happen. It's this incredible, I don't know what it is, a myth. It's this sense that if you've got a computer that works as well as our computers do now and an iPhone that's miraculous, that therefore we could have human systems that are similarly automatic. It's just, but that isn't, every time you see a doctor, the doctor is making all kinds of value judgments. Every time you go to a court, there need to be value judgments. It's just part of the you know, life is complicated.
Mm. Let's go back to the phones. Richard is joining us in Park City, Utah. Richard, welcome.
Hi. Hi. Sorry, you may have addressed this already, but how do you feel about personal responsibility? So I decide to go skiing, and I get hurt, and now I want to sue the resort and everybody else. I'd love to see a judge throw out a case like that and say, you accepted the risk. Take responsibility. How do you feel?
Well, you know, in that case, actually, the law is fairly well developed in most of the Western states. I'm not sure about Utah, that they don't allow those cases because otherwise their big business would go out of business. But yes, responsibility, you know, one of the main themes of the book is that law is supposed to draw these boundaries of the outer boundaries of who can sue for what. So when there's an accident at the playground, the question is not whether something different might have been done, which is always possible, but whether this something that the people who had the accident had responsibility for themselves. And that's an incredibly important role of law, which it has largely abandoned.
Glad you called, Richard. Thanks very much. Let's go back to the phones. Mary is with us in Salt Lake City. Mary, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I am an attorney in Utah and see how some personal injury settlements are calculated in the current tort system we have. And I know that many, many of the huge settlements that are made or the huge jury verdicts that come in because of the cost of future medical care, that what you have is a person who is profoundly injured or profoundly brain damaged, you know, the kind of individual now who's going to need nursing home care or medical care for the rest of decades of life expectancy. Hmm. And that's often what drives huge, huge jury verdicts and drives huge settlements. And it has occurred to me as we've had the healthcare discussion in this country that if there were a single-payer healthcare system where everybody was guaranteed health coverage, then that would got most of the basis for large tort awards, the large personal injury awards, because everybody's future medical problems would be taken care of.
Hmm.
And I've seen that, for example, as one way that the tort system could be addressed. But on the other hand, I'm not sure that tackling healthcare in this country is any easier than tackling tort reform or the premise of the court system.
Well, you're back to that safety net question again, Philip Howard.
Yeah. Well, first of all, that's a good point. I also think, though, that as a factual matter, a lot of the big awards are include, quote, non-economic damages, sort of pain and suffering and that sort of thing. And those, that's basically making someone, saying it, I guess, crudely, making someone rich because something really terrible happened to them. It's not the actual cost. But yes, I'm all for a better safety net. I think a better safety net. I'm also for a more efficient system of justice where people injured can actually get their recovery much quicker. It's one of the problems today is that judges don't see their role as being referees. And so what that means is people can argue and argue and argue. They ask for more discovery, even more discovery, and that's why it stretches out to 5 years, 7 years. And that's why it makes it unaffordable. And at this point, something like only 1.5% of civil cases that are filed go to trial. Hmm. Well, that's no longer that's no longer a system of justice that works, because you need to be able to get to ultimate decision makers. But you're never going to get there until judges do what judges do in England, which is they say, okay, trial's in 3 months. No, you can have 4 depositions each. That's it. No, I'm not going to let you look at every email. That's not that important in this case and cost, you know, millions of dollars or whatever. And until judges start doing that rough justice, then every case becomes a version of Jarndyce v. Jarndyce and Dickens, and it just goes on forever. I mean, literally, we have cases in our law firm that have gone on for decades.
So should we reconsider the civil jury then? Should it just be this? Should this be the purview of just judges then?
Well, I think there's a dramatic misunderstanding about the role of the civil jury. The role of the civil jury has always been to decide disputed issues of fact. You know, who ran the red light, who's telling the truth, that sort of thing. And what's happened in America really always happened, but it only mattered when people got the idea they could sue for anything, is that questions of what are called mixed questions of law and fact, like is a seesaw a reasonable risk? Well, that depends on the factual situation, but it also involves a broader judgment that affects society. They let those go to juries. Well, in fact, because those affect people not in the courtroom, those sorts of decisions, they ought to be made as a matter of law by judges. And so there needs to be a moving of the needle, in my view, back from juries deciding being the only ultimate decision maker to being more in the middle where judges make rulings of standards of care and that sort of thing. And the job of the jury goes back to being deciding, you know, who ran the red light or who's telling the truth. Mm. And you would have litigation end much more quickly because it would be defined better. I talk about how it works in other countries. And in the civil law countries, as soon as a case is brought, the parties appear before the judge. And the judge really grills both sides about what's this really about, how much are the damages really this much, what about this? And within a matter of, you know, a month, a case which in this country would be everybody's encouraged to make the most extreme defenses and the most extreme claims, yeah. You know, over there, you know, it becomes an atomic bomb in this country. Over there, it becomes an acorn.
You know, Mary, thanks for the call, by the way. The sense of community is throughout the book as well, this idea of a different time, you say, when teachers were role models, when lawyers were respected for their integrity, when doctors and political leaders, they were all sort of on the top of the social order. The time was when the common thread was the sense of community, that we were all in this together. Are we so far away from that now, do you think?
Well, I think it's better in small towns, but it's not good in big cities, and it's not good globally. And the reason is because, in my view, well, lots of reasons, but one of the reasons is that we've lost this sense of accountability to common values. Hmm. So if the legal profession thinks it's unprofessional for a law firm to go out and advertise, you know, let's get rich quick with me, you know, anytime. If it's not your fault, we can recover, which is not the legal standard. Then the Bar Association shouldn't let that person belong to the Bar Association. They should make a value judgment that that's a bad thing. And if they did that, if Bar Associations were able to make that value judgment, then that would discourage that kind of activities. Instead, we have this kind of when I was debating the McDonald's hot coffee judge at the end of it, he said, you know, your theories are great, but who am I to judge? Hmm. Well, you know, he's the judge. And if you want values in a society, you have to both live by those values and in one way or another enforce those values. Hmm. You know, people need if the neighbor is making too many demands on the school and it's driving this principal in the school crazy, I think you have an obligation to say, I think what you're doing is wrong. Hmm. And if they persist in doing it, then they're no longer your friends. And it's that sense of ownership of the community that's been lost.
You do say, of course, in the book that there's a counter trend working in this country's favor, where this cycle of social change, which you say comes about every 30 years, is we're due for a big change, I guess, a big shift.
Well, yeah, we are. I mean, if you look at the message that President Obama ran on, you know, the yes, we can, a new era of responsibility. It's wonderful. I mean, the rhetoric is just great, but in order to get there, you know, we need to change these structures. We need to liberate people from this, from the little lawyer sitting on their shoulders, whispering in their ear, and the threat of the one angry person. They need to feel, you know, in order to feel free, when you go through the day and you're making your decisions, whether you're the whatever, but you're the principal or the teacher in a school, you need to feel that if there's a disagreement, that there's somebody on behalf of their of society who sees it as their job to affirmatively protect you. And that person doesn't exist today. Any angry person can claim anything. There's a rule for everything. You can get in trouble even if you didn't do anything. You know, just by putting an arm around a crying child, you could have your whole life ruined. And so we need to restore those authority structures that draw those boundaries in order to restore our freedom.
Philip K. Howard. His book is called Life Without Lawyers, Liberating Americans from Too Much Lie. He joined us from the studios of National Public Radio in New York City. Philip Howard, thanks very much for the time.
Thanks, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the show directed by Mike Anderson, produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.